The Tom Woods Show, episode 1957.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, today I want to talk about politics and religion, politics as a religion. And I'm thinking about an article that Paul Gottfried wrote on this exact subject that appeared in Chronicles magazine, which he edits. And that article, which I will link to at tomwoods.com/1957, is called Politics is the New Religion. Before I get to that, I want to share a few thoughts of my own. And I want to start with something that I know some of you will think is trivial, but it's an email that I found while I was looking for something else this morning. And it turns out it's actually kind of helpful. And it's an email I wrote last year to my newsletter list in June of 2020. And it had to do with the group, the Dixie Chicks. Now, obviously, I understand whatever the Dixie Chicks do is not really of great import to Western civilization, but a lot of principles are illustrated through an accumulation of small examples. And this is simply a small example of a larger phenomenon. So that's what I'm doing. Yes, of course, in itself, it doesn't mean anything. I understand that. Of course, I did get a few emails from people sternly instructing me that this is a minor example, like I didn't know that. Well, you may recall that the Dixie Chicks renamed themselves simply the Chicks. Now, why is that? Well, of course, Dixie. Can't have Dixie. Dixie means wickedness, evil, the South, and all that. And this is a designated oppressor group. And so you can't have any indication that you might have the slightest sympathy with a designated oppressor group. So that word needs to be removed. Now, I have no idea if there was really any pressure on them to change the name. I have no recollection of any such thing. I believe they did this on their own accord. Maybe it got them some, you know, fresh batch of publicity. I don't know. But they did that. So I guess the idea was that if they stayed the Dixie Chicks, we would all have suspected that they supported slavery. I don't know. So now if they're just the Chicks, the problem there is eventually they'll get to a point where they realize that the word Chicks trivializes women's lives, so we can't have Chicks. So then they'll just be reduced to the. So yes, of course, any one example like this, any one example like the Dixie Chicks changing their name, or one particular statue coming down, or one product being taken off the shelves, or the design of it changed, I know any one of those taken in isolation seems silly, but when you combine them all, day after day after day, and then you see works of propaganda being added to school reading lists, well, it does seem all of a piece, doesn't it? And in the new religion that they're creating, we can see very clearly who the heretics are. The heretics are the dissident voices. The heretics are the people who are called all the career-destroying names. They're the people who, if they accidentally speak an uncomfortable truth, are required to walk that back and apologize and do penance. Of course, the difference in this religion is you never get forgiveness. Don't ever expect to be reintegrated into society. You're destroyed. And you're going to cheer your own destruction. You're going to applaud for it. And you're going to make endless statements indicating your remorse. You won't actually ever say anything about what was wrong with your initial statement. We're never going to hear any, because your statement doesn't rely on it's not the truth or falsity of your statement that's the problem. It's the fact that you made it. So we don't actually have to go back and examine what was wrong with your statement. What was wrong with it was that it violated the collection of beliefs that all right-thinking people hold. And so I've compared this to the French Revolution. I mean, the people who fought the hardest against traditional France and its religion are the ones who put a statue of reason in the Cathedral of Notre Dame. These are people who have their own kind of religion. There's no doubt about that. But the key here was their determination to expunge all reference to and all memory of the previous religion and the previous civilization. So all these things that they despise need to be made into objects of ridicule and hatred. Sound familiar? So the Gregorian calendar had to be replaced by a new calendar dating from the execution of the French monarch. We can't have a calendar that centers around a key historical date associated with the old religion, namely the birth of Christ. We can't have these traditional things. So they took statues of saints and actually guillotined them. I mean, what a bunch of idiots. They changed the names of streets. Religious holidays were banned. How can we allow that? That's the old France. We're going to give you the new and improved France, and all we have to do is execute a whole bunch of you who might resist this. We had tens of thousands of priests who had to flee into exile, many of them to England, by the way, and it actually was the example of their lives, lives of these priests in England, that actually helped to melt away eventually a lot of the anti-Catholic discriminatory laws on the books in England. Not to mention there were the gruesome murders of opponents of the regime. So the drownings at Nantes, I've described this in my episode I did on the French Revolution. What number is that? Episode 453. So that's been, what, 6 years. That's been a while. I'll link to that also on the show notes page because you'll find that very, very interesting indeed. The martyrs of Compiègne, also a fascinating and heartbreaking story. But this is the nature of the foe that we face. They do not look at the world as consisting of diverse peoples with varying points of view that ought to be entertained respectfully. No, it consists of enemies who deserve to be silenced and humiliated. And those enemies' old ways of living must be destroyed and rendered odious. And their lingering attachment to them has to be made into an object of ridicule and laughter. And even, by the way, even if you're just moderately different, so let's say Lenin's Russia, if you weren't a Bolshevik, but you were a Menshevik, or you were a social revolutionary, so you were a hard leftist, well, you too will eventually get what's coming to you. And meanwhile, they'll gaslight you by presuming to give you lessons in tolerance and coexistence. They're going to pretend to give you lessons in that. The conservative movement used to criticize its opponents as moral relativists. You remember that? Moral relativism was the big problem in America. But that is not true today with this new religion. That is not true today if it ever was. We're talking about people who absolutely do believe in a moral standard, and they are it. They're not saying, well, you know, maybe some people believe in feminism and other people don't, and, you know, who's to say who's right about that? That is not their point of view. That's what it would be if they were moral relativists, but they're not. They have a morality, and they absolutely intend to ram it down your throat. Now, more specifically, we can take this idea of religious concepts and categories being adapted for political use when it comes to looking at the COVID religion. And there's a journalist named John Hayward who wrote out something pertinent to this, and I want to share that with you now, and it runs as follows. He says, every crisis becomes a religion if it lasts long enough. One factor in that transformation is the beautiful theory phenomenon. The power elite insists its remedies are logical and politically correct, so they must work, even if the actual evidence shows they obviously don't. When beautiful theories crash into hard, cold reality and shatter, faith is the glue used by the elites to put their precious ideas back together. They need militant faith to get the job done. True believers eager to crush doubt and compel obedience by making war on the infidels. Some are swept into the faith because they desperately crave a sense of control over the crisis. They need to believe something can be done, and they'd rather invest their faith in debunked beautiful theories than have no faith at all. Faith is a coin that demands to be spent. Some crave social approval, and the purveyors of beautiful theories have immense political, economic, and cultural power to make their faith seem fashionable. Virtue signaling is such a plague in modern society because the signals are prepackaged and made very easy to send. Some aren't even hoping they can assert control over a crisis by converting to its religion. They'll settle for just having some meaning, some simplicity, a sense that the righteous will fare better than the unbelievers, that virtue will be rewarded while sin is punished. That's a very common impulse with the Church of COVID, since the beautiful theories were so very obviously wrong. There isn't much left of the faith except the visceral communal satisfaction of hoping unbelievers will be punished for their blasphemies with sickness and death. That sort of thing happens with all the crisis religions, although not usually as quickly and obviously as with the Church of COVID. Look at the endless stream of movies about how the world became an apocalyptic hellscape because people didn't believe in global warming. The last resort of every crisis religion, the last thing that puts asses in the pews, is that addiction to misery porn, the collective hope that unbelievers will suffer someday, and everyone will admit the true faith was right all along as Judgment Day crashes down upon them. The elite will never have the humility to admit they were wrong, and they'll never give up on politically or financially profitable solutions, even when they obviously don't solve the problem. Founding a crisis religion means they never have to say they're sorry. That applies to some very long-standing crises, like the war on poverty, whose nostrums long ago transformed into fantastically expensive articles of religious faith, even as mountains of data accumulated that proved they were utter failures and often made the problem worse. You can look for some telltale signs of a crisis transforming into a religion. The most obvious one is when the high priests tell you the war you've been drafted into will never end. They become very angry when asked to define success or failure or lay out exit strategies. Watch for the moment when you're told science means not asking questions, defying dogma, or challenging consensus. That is the literal definition of faith, not science. Always keep an eye out for moving goalposts, which are the signature miracle of crisis religions, their version of parting the waters or loaves and fishes. Crisis religions work very hard to make their faith unfalsifiable by constantly changing the standards of evidence. Check to see if certain people are accumulating huge amounts of money and power from a crisis. That's a pretty good sign it's turning into a religion. A crisis should be solved as quickly and efficiently as possible. Don't let it fester long enough to become a special interest. Above all, look for the whiff of arrogance to develop around a crisis. Wise religions and effective crisis managers have something in common, a sense of humility. Crisis religions are militant faiths that quickly become arrogant, smug, and totalitarian. Dedicated people who truly want to solve a problem will look for evidence their analysis is wrong or their policies aren't working, and make adjustments as quickly as possible, no matter the cost or embarrassment to themselves. This is humility. Crisis religions are arrogant. They reject criticism, insist their beautiful theories must be right because they're ideologically pure. They fit snugly into a worldview that must not be challenged. Their plans only fail because their commands were disobeyed or sabotaged. The high priests of a crisis religion see devils everywhere, leering at them from the rubble of every failure. Only sin can explain why their beautiful theories are tarnished. Failure is never their fault, so it must be yours. They find your lack of faith disturbing. And you know what? A lot of people want to see the world that way, including a great many self-described atheists. They hunger for the comfort of faith and the vibrant energy of militancy. They want to be right, and they want the wrong to suffer for their folly. Conservatives think religious faith in the state is terrifying and wonder why so many embrace it. It's because uncertainty is much more frightening. A simple false story is better than a complex true one, and with enough faith, maybe we can force the simple story to be true. And of course, the simple story, this is now me again, the simple story is the virus is your fault, and if only you wouldn't do X, Y, and Z, we would fix this thing. Well, I'm just looking here right now. You should follow me on Twitter, by the way, at Thomas E. Woods. I'm looking at something I retweeted. It's a graphic, and it says, despite varying rules around masks, schools, and vaccines, hospitalizations began rising in the mid-Atlantic region simultaneously, and all are growing at a similar pace. So you look at all different policies in this place, Delaware, Ohio, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey. And their graphs, their numbers in terms of hospitalizations on this particular graph, are all moving exactly the same way, same numbers, same trajectory, all the same. And there are graphs like this. We could just spend all day and all night and all day and all night forever and ever showing you hundreds and hundreds of graphs that look like this. where different places with the same policies have exactly the same results. Now, that's discouraging to people who think the state is all-powerful, or who think if we all just put our heads together and do something, we can put a stop to it. There's nothing we can't do. All this superstition about what's possible through coercion and violence and collectivism and fascism. But there are those charts, those merciless charts, one after the other, and they won't stop. And they keep saying, none of this matters. None of it matters. You do this policy, they do that one. The hospitalization trend is the same in all these places. The virus is seasonal and regional and just blasts right through your stay 6 feet away stickers on the floor and your silly masks. Now, by the way, I'm very far from the first person to make these kinds of connections. Of course, I'm sharing with you the work of other people who've done so, but it's been done for a long time. There have been a lot of scholars who have pointed out the similarities between Marxism and Christianity. I mean, similarities in the sense that they use similar categories, not that they're teaching the same things, but there's certainly an eschatology in Marxism. And as Paul Gottfried puts it in his article that I want to get to now, Marxism can be thought of as a body of evolving theory with its own church doctors and sacred traditions. And of course, not to mention plenty of heretics. Gottfried says, ideologies of the left like communism and wokeism recycle Christian elements, which even in their mangled or denatured state, are still recognizable in terms of their point of origin. Indeed, it is impossible for me to imagine any leftist ideology that does not adapt such Christian principles as universalism and the spiritual equality of all people. The left also recycles teachings about serving the poor and about the harmony of the messianic age, which are present in both the Old and New Testaments. This is not to deny, says Gottfried, that what ideologues do with what they have taken denatures the borrowed principles and teachings. But they can easily extract their key themes from the religion they are working to destroy. In its American form, Paul says that political religion has masked itself as civil religion, which celebrates increasingly those who are viewed as progressive heroes, and it also provides an at least implicit exaltation of consolidated managerial government and assigns a special place in its pantheon to Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, both significant builders of the U.S. administrative state. And then I want to read this paragraph from Paul's article. In modern America's celebration of who we are, the heroes sometimes change to fit an advancing political agenda. Thus, such, quote, racist figures as General Robert E. Lee and John C. Calhoun have been desacralized, while the more politically useful Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama have been added to the liberal democratic communion of saints. This manipulation of the pantheon of heroes by the state and more recently the media is different from the reverence for past rulers that one finds in traditional monarchical societies. And here's the key. It is not based on respect for a dynasty that is coextensive with the life of the nation and which expresses the continuity of a people. The heroes in America's changing civil religion are intended to reflect a revolutionary process. Then skipping ahead a bit, Paul says leftist political religions are entirely systematic in how they change society. They will not stop their work until every mind has been reshaped. And he says that the left attracts adherents successfully, in part because it wields myths that fit into a culture that has long been Christian. So he says, unlike the right, the left has been able to harness moral guilt on behalf of its transformative vision. And it has weaponized hatred by recasting it as moral indignation in the face of injustice or prejudice. Now, isn't that the case? It's not that these people are burning with desire to see a more just world and whatever. They have weaponized hatred by recasting it in this way. That's why when you observe these people, they're always, you can see it by looking at them and observing their behavior and reading the way they write and the way they think about people who disagree with them. It is clearly motivated by hate, but they know they can't get away with that. So they cast it as, well, it's not that I hate them, I'm just overwhelmed with moral indignation at the injustices they're perpetrating. Yeah, okay, sure, sure you are. All right, I want to take a minute to talk about something happy, and then after I finish talking about something happy, we can get right back to the depression. And that is that every month, and I checked, I subscribed August 13th, 2019. So every month for 2 years, I have received a piece of happiness in my mailbox. And if you want to be a hit with your significant other, you will follow in my footsteps. Now, what is that bit of happiness? It is the Happily Date Box. Every month, we get a box with a different theme inside, containing a music playlist and activities of all kinds and games and conversation starters that bring you closer together with your significant other. Sometimes it's competitive, sometimes it's cooperative, but it's always fun and relaxing. We've had boxes with an 80s theme, a Japan theme, a stargazing theme, all kinds of different things that help give us a special night together. Show your significant other that you value time together by checking out the Happily Date Box. And because you know old Woods, take 50% off your first date at tomwoods.com/date. All right, let's talk about depressing things again. And then we get to one of the things that drives Paul crazy, which is the state of American conservatism, which fashions itself and thinks of itself as standing up against the left. But yet, as Paul says, the left has even been able to maneuver its wannabe opposition into becoming a pale imitation of itself, a tendency illustrated by the conservative establishment's borrowing of the left's rhetoric and positions. The left, he says, operates like a runaway train. Conceding any ground to the left will not cause it to stop roaring forward. Only a counterforce with equivalent power can halt its advance. And then finally, he says, like the ancient Gnostics, the left sees itself as engaged in a struggle of good against evil in its own equivalent of the end times. It therefore deals ruthlessly with its adversaries, standing in the way of the long-sought victory over prejudice and fascism. Misrepresenting reality, stealing elections, and allowing alleged right-wing extremists to rot in jail are small prices to pay for the prejudice-free age that they imagine awaits the righteous. This golden age will come more quickly if the opposition can be driven out of the public square and into fearful silence. That is exactly what's happening. And again, says Paul, the trouble is that the left is not coming up against an opposition that really wants to stand in opposition. It's an opposition that wants to meet the left on its own ground. It wants to presume that the left is acting in good faith. And so we too, we're also egalitarians, and we also favor the things you favor. Not really, no. Nope, no, we don't. We favor exactly what you want. We just want to bring it about in a different way. Nope, that is not the case. Against the left's contagious, militant political religion, Paul concludes, one cannot win with such drivel. And if I can just return to something I hinted at before, there's no forgiveness in this religion. And yet, people who are attacked as heretics act as if there is. If I just apologize really profusely, and I humiliate myself to a preposterous degree, they have to let me back into society. They just have to. But they don't have to. Whose principle is that? That if I am sufficiently contrite, I should be allowed back in? That's your principle. That's the principle of decent people. But if you are a committed revolutionary who is monomaniacally focused on one particular outcome, namely the eradication of people like you, and society dominated and run by people like them, well, they don't hold views like yours. They're not as friendly as you. And let's say I know a guy who maybe 10 years ago or so wound up getting massively attacked in the media for some previous things he had said. And virtually all of them were defensible. Virtually all of them. I mean, a couple of them were a little over the top, but he was a radio guy, and you know, radio people say over-the-top things all the time, and nobody cares. And this guy was viciously attacked. And eventually, after he'd overcome the shock of what happened to him, he decided to start criticizing his former friends and make sure everybody knew that he believed in all the pieties that the left insists we genuflect to. And again, criticize all his former colleagues, sometimes just implicitly, but just to make sure that, yeah, these are people who held the views that I held as of 10 minutes ago, but I am not one of those people. And it just went on. It was just insufferable. And it gained him nothing. He was not let back into society. He wasn't allowed to be influential unless he and other people decided to fight, not just say, oh, well, actually, I have a lot of left-wing views. If you look closely, actually, that's not going to get you anything. You're not going to be on television or be advising an important person or whatever. That's not going to do it. So either you just fight back, you fight like a fighter and say, no, I don't accept any of your stupid opinions. There are occasionally people who do that, who stand up and say, I don't accept any of your stupid opinions. They're all wrong, and here's why. You can rally some people to you. The left will hate you, but they're going to hate you. They're going to have contempt for you if you pathetically try to lick their boots. That's the thing. So if you're going to be taken down with some dignity. You know, build up an audience of people who cheer for you because at least you fight and you don't just fall into the, well, I guess I am a heretic in your religion, but I think it's because you've misunderstood my views, which in fact are actually the, no, come on. We have to be proud heretics when it comes to the COVID religion, the left-wing religion, the woke religion. We're proud heretics. I don't want your forgiveness. They don't give forgiveness. I don't even want it. I don't want to be forgiven by people. When you're forgiven, the person forgiving you has the moral high ground because you've done something wrong. I haven't done anything wrong. And of all people to claim the moral high ground, the people perpetrating the COVID religion and all these other religions are not exactly in that position. All right, now, two things that I forgot to tell you the other day, and I want to tell them to you now. First thing is, I mentioned a website, gunloot.com, where one of my listeners has, merchandise for people who like the message of this particular episode right here, okay, and aren't afraid to spread that to other people. Well, I forgot to mention that at gunloot.com, if you use coupon code Woods, which I hope you check at every possible coupon code opening that you have out there, always check Woods, you never know. He's taking 20% off any order for a limited time. So use code Woods when you go to gunloot.com. The other thing I want to tell you about involves our friend Gene Epstein. This coming September 8th, which is coming right up, September 8th, 2021, Gene's Soho Forum is having an event, and the debate is on the following topic. Is new legislation voter suppression or election integrity? So, you know, there are these bills in various state legislatures, and people are saying that it's an attack on our democracy and all this nonsense. Well, there's actually going to be a debate on this. So the debate will be between Hans von Spakovsky at the Heritage Foundation and Eliza Swerenbecker at the Brennan Center for Justice. This will take place both in person and streaming, and both people who attend in person and online get to vote, because that's how Oxford debates work. You vote beforehand, how you feel about the resolution, then you hear the debate, then you vote a second time, and whoever changed more minds is declared the winner. So it's taking place Wednesday, September 8th at the Sheen Center on Bleecker Street in Manhattan. So get all the details and tickets to either be in person or to watch the stream. The work Gene does is really important, and I hope you'll support it. So the website is thesohoforum.org. All right, everybody, that is going to do it. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.